Okay, we're about to start. This is one of our very exciting question and answer sessions with Rosh Hashiva. We thank Rav Schechter Shlita for coming as always. The shiur is sponsored by Saul and Sherry Zimmerman in memory of Saul's mother, Ida Zimmerman, Shama Shavon Aliyah. So I guess, Rebbe, if I can throw out the first question, and we'll take it as it comes. Question is about kitnios in chewable medications and acid, etc. Two parts to the question. Is it okay for a chole, and is heartburn enough to qualify one as a chole? In other words, if it wasn't heartburn, then if it would be anything else, what's considered to be, for example, the idea of mechesh ba'alma, as far as the average person, in order to be matur them to have something which contains kidneys?
Mm-hmm. Kidneys is a custom that Ashkenazic Jews have. The Sephardim do not have this custom. Over the generations, many Ashkenazi rabbis were trying to do away with the custom, but they didn't succeed. It keeps on growing bigger and bigger. But it's only a minhag. It's only a minhag. It's not even a din midirabbanan. So in order to violate a biblical prohibition, you have to be really a chole she'esh b'sakana. It has to be a suffix, sakanas nefashis. In order to violate an isa d'rabbanan, a lot of times is sufficient if the person is a chole she'esh b'sakana. Chole she'esh b'sakana means a person has a condition that prevents him from functioning normally. And then in order to violate a minhag, you don't even have to be a chole she'esh b'sakana. As long as the person has a mechesh b'alma, he has a slight bellyache, and if he'll violate the minhag, he'll feel better. That'll remove the slight pain, so that's permissible. For example, we have a minhag that's very old from the days of the Gemara, that we wait 6 hours in between fleshiks and milchiks. There's a minhag that dates back from the days of the Gemara. So on the Shulchan Aruch, and the commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch, they quote from the Chasam Sofer, who was known as a big machmir. Chasam Sofer says that to wait 1 hour after fleshiks, min hatar, biblically, it's only prohibited to eat meat and milk that were cooked together. To have a cup of milk at the same time that you're having a fleshig meal, that's only prohibited midirabbanan. And to wait 1 hour, the Chasam Sofer thinks, is probably also an isa d'rabbanan. It's prohibited midirabbanan to have milchiks within the first hour. That's what it says in the Zohar. But to wait the extra 5 hours, that's only a minog, even though it's an old, old minog. So the Chasam Sofer says, if a person has a bellyache, has a slight bellyache, he can function, he's able to function. But he has a slight ache and pain. And years ago, they used to think that if you drink warm milk, that was considered a refuah for certain sicknesses. So then we would permit the person to have a cup of warm milk within the last 5 hours. But to be permitted to drink milk within the first hour after having the fleshiks, that would only be permissible if the person really is unable to function. He has such a condition that prevents him from functioning normally. He can't walk around, he has to lay in bed, or he's aches and pains all over, and everything is slowed down, or he has a splitting headache, and he can't function normally, has no appetite, and so on. So if he's really a chole she'esh b'sakana, then you can violate a rabbinical prohibition. But as far as kidney is concerned, it's only a minhag. And if a person has a slight ache and pain, it would be permissible. I had a neighbor, fellow lived in the neighborhood, not my neighbor, lived in the neighborhood several years ago. He passed away the first night of Pesach. So he told me before Pesach, he can't hold any food down. He was very sick, can't hold any food down. He keeps on throwing everything up. The only thing that he can eat is some kind of kidneys food. He wants to know, is it permissible to eat it on Pesach? I said, of course it's permissible. It's the only thing you can eat, no question. As it turned out, he died the first night of Pesach. He didn't live so long to eat the kidneys. But strictly speaking, it is permissible, sure. Sometimes you have Sephardi marries an Ashkenaziyah. You have a mixed marriage. Or Hasidim have a minhag that they don't eat gebroks, and Misnagdim don't have the minhag. There's only going left at the minhag, so the Hasidim follow the Chassidish Rebbe's, and the Misnagdim follow the Vilna Gaon. So what do you do if you have a mixed marriage? The husband is a Chassid and the wife is not. So there are different types of minhagim. There's a minhag hayachid, a person accepts upon himself a personal minhag. So it doesn't have anything to do with anybody else. So a minig, it's the accepted opinion of Shulchan Aruch is like Tosfos, then a minig is binding midirabbanan. We consider it as if it were a neder midirabbanan. Biblically, to be considered a neder, you have to say something b'peh. Nefesh kisishova levate b'sosayim. The Chumash says you have to take a shvua or a neder by pronouncing it with your lips. I accept upon myself a neder, I accept upon myself a shvua. So when a person or a community has a minog, they never said, I accept upon myself. So biblically, there is no neder, there is no shvua. But midirabbanan, we consider it as if it were a neder. So if a person accepted upon himself a personal minhog, and he no longer wants to continue observing the minhag, so the Shulchan Aruch says, based on the Tosfos Pshat and the Gemara, that you have to ask, you have to go to a bezin and make hataras nedarim. Not so difficult to make hataras nedarim. The person comes and he says, I don't have charata for observing the minhag toif. He's going to have charata. He's going to say, I feel bad that I observed. So he's going to lose all the reward that he should have gotten for observing the minhag toif. So I don't have charata for observing the minhag toif. I have charata that I should have said b'li neder. I shouldn't have accepted it as a neder. I should have said b'li neder. So you make hataras nedarim. So this hataras nedarim is only needed if the person plans no longer to observe it. Let's say a person has a personal minig, that a person is not the Hasidish family, and he decides he wants to observe gibrochs, or a Sfardi decides he wants not to eat kidneys. It's not the family minig, he accepts upon himself this minig. So if he gets stuck one Pesach, he has to eat by his cousin. He has nowhere else. He's studying in Yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael. There's no other place to go, and the best place is by his cousin, who's a Sfardi, and they're going to give him kidneys, or his Misnagin is going to give him gibrochs. So if it's once in a long while that the person has to violate the minig, so the commentaries write on Shulchan Aruch that you don't need a hataras nedarim for that. Whenever a person has a minig toiv, so it's as if it were built into the minig toiv, that once in a long while, if I'll get stuck, I won't have to observe the minig. That's self-understood. But let's say the person decides from now on he no longer wants to observe this minig toiv, so then you're supposed to have hataras nedarim. So this only is meaningful if it's a personal minig that I accepted upon myself. But if all the Hasidim in the world have this minig not to eat gibrochs, and all the Ashkenazim have the minig not to eat kidneys, so it's not my minig. I'm not the Baal HaNeder over here. The minig is the whole community has such a minig. So if you want to make Hataras Nedarim, you have to get the whole Jewish community. You have to get all the Ashkenazim to be mata their minig type of. You can't have one person. He's not the Baal HaNeder. He can't make Hataras Nedarim. If he got stuck, he has to eat by his sister, whatever. So then we would permit him without a Hataras Nedarim. What do you do if you have a mixed marriage? So what are you going to say? This is not a personal minig. This is a minig of a community. So there's a neder of a yochid. An individual person takes a neder. So an individual person can accept upon himself a minig toiv. Minig is binding. We consider as if it were a neder. And then there's a shvua of the kehillah. The kehillah can take a shvua. We have psukim and shir Hashem, hishbati eschem and osi Yerushalayim. Kodesh Baruch Hu had the Jewish people take three different oaths. The shalosh shvuas that the Gemara talks about. So there's a neder ha-yochid, and then there's a neder ha-tzibur. So there's a minig ha-yochid, a minig ha-tzibur. So if a couple gets married, one is a Sfardi, one is an Ashkenazi, yeah, let's say, it doesn't make sense to say the husband belongs to that kehillah and the wife belongs to this kehillah. They have to belong to, if they're married, they have to belong, if they're shalom bayis, they have to belong to the same kehillah. So either we assume the husband enters the kehillah of the wife, or the wife enters the kehillah of the husband. So if the husband is a ger, or the husband is a bal tshuva and has no family tradition, and the wife has traditions from centuries, she's from a religious family for centuries, so what are you going to say? She enters his kehillah. He doesn't belong to any kehillah. He just converted 5 years ago. He just became a bal tshuva a couple of years ago. So he enters her kehillah. And if they both have traditions, the husband and the wife both have traditions from centuries ago, so then usually we assume that the wife enters the reshus of the husband. That's how the Chumash describes it. The Isha is Bebeis Baila. She joins the husband's kehillah. And then we assume you don't even need a Hataras Nedarim. Let's say the girl was an Ashkenazi, and she marries a Sfardi, and the Sfardi meet the kidneys on Pesach. So she doesn't have to have a Hataras Nedarim. She belongs to a different kehillah now. Or let's say a person is from a Hasidish family. His great-grandfather went with a beard and payas and the whole works. And his grandfather was a little less, and his father is much less, and he is mamishna. He has nothing to do with Hasidim at all. So the Shulchan Aruch, the Gemara talks about a person was brought up in one community, they had a whole bunch of minhagim. Then he moves to a different community. So does he plan to move back? Is he only here temporarily on business? Only here for a month or for a year? He plans to go back, or he does not plan to go back? If he no longer plans to go back, so he's no longer a member of that community, he's a member of this community. So whatever minhagim he had over there are no longer binding. He's no longer part of that kehillah. So let's say the great-grandfather was a real chassid, and the grandfather was a little less, and the father is mamish less, and he has no shaychus at all with the chassidim. He sees them once in a while, but he doesn't act at all like a chassid. So he converted. He became a misnagid. He learned in a misnagdish yeshiva. But the same thing, you have Svardim learning Panovich. So they talk Yiddish. Where do they come up to talk it? And everything is like Ashkenazim. So they converted. So they became Ashkenazim. Okay, so they're no longer, a lot of them are no longer culturally Svardim, so they don't identify with the Svardim anymore. So it's like they converted to a different kehillah. You join a different kehillah, so you're no longer bound with them and hug him of the old kehillah.
What is the adoption of a personal kehillah? Is that with some verbal articulation, or is it not intended?
No, if a person articulates it, I accept upon myself, then it's a real neder. Even if he never said explicitly, but he observes a minog, so a minog tov is binding mitam neder midirabbana. Minog tov, if it's a minog shtus, it's not binding. But if a minog tov, it's binding midirabbana, we consider it as if it were a neder.
Question? Still on this topic?
So is there any hakada on somebody just waking up one morning and saying, you know what, I think that the Edok and Mizrach have it right and I want to convert to the Mizrach?
He's going to convert lock, stock, and barrel. Everything. He's going to daven like them, and he's going to follow. And the slichas, Rosh Chodesh Elul. Like Rabbi Schwab said, you want to only wait 3 hours between flesh and smoke, then you got to say the long slichas on their Rosh Hashanah. They say 2 hours worth of slichas, and you got to go all the way.
Right, but there would be, somebody came to you and said, Rabbi
Schwab,
I'm thinking of doing that.
Would
you say,
isn't there hay? But you have to be honest. You have to belong to some kehillah or another. You like that kehillah, so join that kehillah. Okay.
Question was regarding the fact that this year Pesach falls out, we're already in daylight savings time. Question was regarding a young children, although they, of course, the Shulchan Aruch talks about we're supposed to keep the children up. Is there anything to do second night for perhaps to have certain parts of the Seder even for the purposes of the children, even if it's not legitimately part of the Seder? What does Rebbe think about doing something like that so that the children can function and be a part of the...
I think you try to give the children a nap during the daytime so they'll be able to stay up at night if they didn't have a nap. So you do a little bit.
I promised I was going to ask the question, so I just answered it. Okay. Can an Israeli do melacha, turning on or off lights, running a dishwasher, etc., for someone on the second day of Yom Tov here in America? And what if they do those things for you when you're not at home? And can you ask directly? If yes, can you ask directly, or do you have to hint?
In the Shulchan Aruch, the accepted opinion is that if you have an Israeli who happens to be visiting in America and he plans to go back to Israel, he still has to, he only davens Yantav Tiga davening on the first day. The second day he davens Tfilas Chol, because it's not for him, it's not really Yantav, but he's not permitted to do Malacha even when no one is watching. Because we assume that Malacha, he's not permitted to do anything but for Hesya that will demonstrate that he's not observing Yantav Sheni. So we assume in the Shulchan Aruch that Malacha will always be discovered. Someone will always discover the fact that he did Malacha. I had in my building, I live in a big apartment building, must be 100 apartments there, so maybe 100 apartments, I don't know. So there was a professor, a very learned professor from Eretz Yisrael, from Hebrew University, who very religious, very learned. He came for a year to teach in the Jewish Theological Seminary because they paid him more money. Paid more money than yeshiva. He would have liked to be in yeshiva, but he came for the money. So 2 years after he went back to Eretz Yisrael, very learned, very fine professor. He used to sit, we only talked together when we sat in the sukkah together. The rest of the year he was running in his work and I was running doing mine. At sukkahs we spoke together. So he went back to Eretz Yisrael. 2 years later, an almana who lived on my floor says, remember that professor who was here? I say, yeah. He wasn't Orthodox, was he? I said, what do you mean? Of course he was Orthodox. He was very observant, very learned, big Talmud Chacham. She says, no. She knows that he turned on the lights on Yontif. I said, maybe it was Yontif Sheni. Maybe the second day Yontif, he was an Israeli. She said, that could be, she doesn't remember. Now, his windows did not face the street. His windows faced the wall of the next building. And this woman, what she saw was the reflection of the lights going on. So I said, maybe you had it on the Shabbos clock. She said, no, it was going on and off. It couldn't be Shabbos clock. So I said, it must have been the second day Yontif. She said, that could be. See, he thought that no one's going to know that he's turning on the lights. He didn't realize the almana was watching that he turned on the lights. Rabbi Chalap told us about some Irish Jewish writer. He said he's a famous name. I forgot already the name. Who writes in his autobiography that he gave up the religion, he gave up the Jewish religion at the age of 6 because his father was a big Talmud Chacham, his father was a rabbi, and his father said in shul that on Yontif he's not allowed to turn on the lights. It was when they first started using electric lights in Europe, so many rabbanim were of the opinion you're permitted to turn on lights just like you're allowed to turn on, you're allowed to light a candle from a red existing flame. So many rabbanim thought it's permissible to turn on the lights. And after many years, it was accepted that you're not allowed to turn on lights. Rabbi Soloveitchik years ago, in the early years, used to turn on lights on Yontif, and then the whole house was all lit up. You can't turn them off. When you need a light, he thought you're allowed to turn them off. Then in a couple of hours, the whole house was lit up, and he's not allowed to turn them off. And then later, he had adopted the generally accepted opinion, you're not allowed to turn on lights on Yontif. So this rabbi would say in shul, not permissible to turn on lights, but this 6-year-old son of his was always very curious, and whenever they told him to go to sleep, he thought he was going to be missing something that's going on. So he would always sit on top of the staircase and listen to everything that's going on. And then when everybody went to sleep, his father would go down, his father would take the candles. On Yontif, his father would take the candles from the kitchen, from the dining room table, and go down to his study in the basement and learn with a niggun. So this boy, 6-year-old boy, would sit on the top of the staircase, he would tiptoe down from upstairs to the first floor to listen to his father learning. And he would hear the father learning with a niggun, and then he would see the candles would get dimmer, then the flames would go out, and all of a sudden the electric lights went on in the basement. And there were no elves there, and there were no goyim there. Obviously the father turned on the lights, so he decided his father's a hypocrite. His father tells the Balabatim at shul, you're not allowed to turn on the lights, and he himself turns on the lights. So he decided, the father's a hypocrite, he gave up the whole Jewish religion. So Rabbi Chalap is telling us what probably happened was his father really thought that it's permissible to turn on the lights, but he didn't want to fight with the other Rabbanim in public. So he told the Balabatim, you're not allowed to turn on the lights, and he personally felt you're allowed to turn on. So when the candles went out and he wanted to continue to learn, so he turned on the lights thinking that no one is watching. He didn't realize his own son is watching. His own son decided the father's a hypocrite and he gave up the whole religion. So that's what it says in Shulchan Aruch. We assume that whenever one is going to do malacha, malacha will always be discovered. Someone will always find out that the fellow did malacha. That's always considered b'ferhesi. There's another question. What if I'm in Eretz Yisrael? So many assume that a Ben Chutzlotz who's visiting in Eretz Yisrael is supposed to observe 2 days Yontif. Rabbi Yosef Karo lived in Eretz Yisrael. And he writes in his tshuvas that there always would be tourists who came from the Arab, they didn't come from America, they didn't come from England, they came from the Arab countries bordering on Eretz Yisrael. And the practice was for many, many years that they would observe 2 days Yontif. The one who disagreed was the Chacham Tzvi in the 1700s who never visited Eretz Yisrael, he was never there. So he thought it doesn't make sense. His son was Rabbi Yankov Emden, who went like his father, that he also thought that doesn't make any sense. But in Eretz Yisrael, the practice was for centuries that the visitors from Chutz Lartz have to observe 2 days Yontif. So that's a question. Is a Jew from Chutz Lartz in Eretz Yisrael who's observing second day Yontif, am I permitted to ask a Jew there who only has 1 day Yontif, am I permitted to ask him to do malacha for me? So that's a dispute in the commentaries on Shulchan Aruch. Rabbi Soloveitchik thought that it's certainly permissible, that it is okay.
My question is that we know in Chutz Lartz you observe 2 days Yontif, and Why? Because that was the minhag of our fathers, so we follow it today. But when you go to Israel, at the time of the Gemara, all the Jews who were in Israel observing one day, Yom Kippur, he knew what the proper day was when you were in Israel. So why would there be any reason to ever observe 2 days of Yom Kippur if you're in Israel, when you actually know in Israel it's only exactly what the day is?
It's a very good question, but that was the accepted opinion for many centuries, that even a Jew who's visiting in Eretz Yisrael still observes 2 days Yom Kippur. Yeah.
So then, I know, for example, last year we had a situation on Rosh Hashanah, which is not related to any second day thing, where there was a light left on in one of the bedrooms, and someone said, oh, my housekeeper's at the house, you can go, and my housekeeper knows, you just go and tell her you have something in your house, and she just magically knows what to do, or whatever, or the hinting, or whatever. So if there's a situation like that, is it better to ask the non-Jewish person as opposed to the Israeli person?
Here in America.
Second day, you have to, if there's a light on.
Then you can't sleep. You won't be able to sleep at night.
Right. So
yeah.
You ask the Israeli who's sleeping in your house?
No. Yes, the non-Jew. Right. That says in Shulchan Aruch. Right.
To
ask a non-Jew is only prohibited midirabbanan, and to turn off lights is only prohibited midirabbanan. To extinguish a flame is a biblical prohibition if you plan to use the logs, if you plan to use the charcoal. But if you're turning on the lights, turning off the lights, there is no charcoal. So that's only prohibited midirabbanan. So to ask a non-Jew to do something that's only prohibited midirabbanan, that's called the shvus. So if it's b'maka mitzvah, that's permissible. So I want to sleep at night. The lights are going to keep everybody awake. So it's better to ask the non-Jew.
I think your question is, the alternative is asking the Jew who is second day yantiv, so it's not yantiv for them. So it wouldn't be an issue for them.
No.
It's the rabbanan.
Right, but he's not permitted to do a malacha.
But that's also derabbanan.
Still?
No. Second isn't a derabbanan.
Yeah, but it's still better to ask the non-Jew.
So could you extend that principle that you're going to see malacha if it's done to like with 9/11 with the Agunas, when someone's missing and there's no body, there's no DNA, that you're going to find them if that person's alive someplace? That the same way you're going to see Malacha, the missing husband will be seen someplace if he chose that day to run away.
There was such an opinion in the days of the Rishonim, based on a passage in the Gemara, that if enough time goes by and we didn't discover, we didn't hear anything from the husband, so we have the right to assume that he's dead. So generally speaking, that was not the accepted opinion. So usually when you have a case of an aguna, your mitzar, if you combine together different opinions, even though each one by itself is not accepted, but you combine as a tzir of different opinions to be mekel. They found a heter for all agunas.
In the days when the guests of Israel were rare, or today if we were in a place in Israel where there were few other than Israelis present, an American visitor. What about the concept of Al-Tiprosh Minatsikur? Does that not apply in those circumstances?
You should, what about Al-Tiprosh Minatsikur? What do you want him to do? Not to be Parish Minatsikur. No, he should stay home.
2 days?
He shouldn't daven in shul in public, Yantav Diga davening. He should stay home and do quietly. He has to observe the second day Yantav. Means if the tzibba is doing something that I ought to go along with, so I should go along. Yeah, I can't go along. I'm obligated to observe the second day Yom Tov. Yosef Karo, who lived in Eretz Yisrael in the 1500s, the author of the Shulchan Aruch, writes that it's not permissible for the B'nai Chutz Lords to make their own minyan. Now they do it all over, in all the hotels, and all the yeshivas, everybody makes. If there really is a minyan, so there's no added aver for me to join the minyan, but it's not right for me to organize the minyan. You shouldn't organize a minyan. So the B'nai Chutz Lord said they're going to daven Yontav Dik. They should daven quietly at home. They should mind their own business and daven quietly at home.
I mean, a question that came up as far as in the last number of years, there's been a change by the major kashrus agencies as far as pills obviously being taken on Pesach, but also the still seems to be concerning mouthwash or toothpaste, and this concept of denatured alcohol, comes up in deodorants and perfumes, and wanted to get Rebbe's feeling on that subject.
I think all of these things, even if they have chametz, they're not fit for animals to eat. Chametz has a chumra. Any other tray for food, chazer, anything else, if it's not fit for human consumption, it's already mutter. And chametz has a chumra, the Gemara says, it has to be not fit for animal consumption. Pills are not fit. If you put a bowl of pills in front of a normal animal, he's not going to eat the pills.
So as a follow-up to that, I had someone ask me the other night that there is a toothpaste for their dog that they put on their dog's teeth every day. So
the dog enjoys eating it, or
dog doesn't spit it out; it just stays in. But that's for the dog's teeth.
So and that, has chametz that, in it.
Your stomach has chametz. Would that change the idea of nifsal me'achilas kelev?
You have to squeeze some of the toothpaste in a bowl and see if the dog will eat it on his own. If the dog likes to eat it, if he licks it up, he laps it up. That means it's fit for
animals. That particular is fit, meaning okay. It's made for a dog, but not lavdafka anything else. Any other normal toothpaste.
Yeah.
The question was about pills, toothpaste, mouthwash. So what is your...
Pills are not fit for human consumption, unless they're chewables, have flavor in them.
What about toothpaste?
Toothpaste, normal people don't eat toothpaste. And maybe babies eat toothpaste. Little children don't know what it's all about.
You use a regular kosher mouthwash. I'm asking, are you permissible to use a regular kosher mouthwash?
What's kosher? What do you mean by kosher? Regular mouthwash?
Not kosher. I think all the mouthwashes have non-kosher ingredients for all year long. I think all toothpaste in the world has
glycerin.
Well, it's all. It all has
been. I go to hear a coach say, "Can I buy special vitamins in the store there? Because they're kosher vitamins. Are you saying that one could use a normal one-a-day vitamin? Because
it won't hurt you." Yeah. Moshe Feinstein says that strictly speaking, all these pills are kosher because nifsa machilos adam. But he says we recommend if a person can avoid it, he should, because the Talmud said, the Shulchan Aruch says this, not the Talmud. Shulchan Aruch says that when the mother can't nurse her baby, and she has to get a non-Jewish woman to nurse the baby, so we should try to request from the non-Jewish woman that she shouldn't eat non-kosher food, because the non-kosher food is going to go through her system, and when the baby is going to drink the milk from the non-Jewish woman, it's going to have an effect. Now, strictly speaking, the milk that comes from the non-Jewish woman is just as kosher as the milk that comes from the Jewish woman. But indirectly, the baby will be imbibing some chasa. So we recommend, if one can, you should avoid it, because the Medrash says that when Moshe Rabbeinu's mother gave him, when the daughter of Paro found the baby, Moshe Rabbeinu was crying, and she thought he was hungry. He wanted to nurse. So she gave him over to a non-Jewish woman, so he didn't want to nurse from the non-Jewish woman. Then they called the mother, they called Moshe Rabbeinu's mother, so he nursed from his mother. So the Medrash says because the non-Jewish women ate non-kosher food and Moshe Rabbeinu was destined to become a big holy tzaddik and a big prophet, so we don't want to ruin the chances of our children of becoming a big tzaddik and a big prophet, so we don't want them to nurse from non-Jewish women who may have possibly eaten non-kosher food. So Moshe Feinstein recommends if you can get, if it's not too expensive, you can get kosher pills that have no non-kosher ingredients, you should try that. But strictly speaking, it's kosher anyway. All the pills, if they don't taste good, not roi l'achila. When Adwe first went into business, they're still in business.
Yeah.
Adwe made the Hungarians, they made the kosher le'pesach toothpaste. So they came to the old Rabbi Breuer for a hashgacha. So he refused to give them a hashgacha on principle because he sized them up and he decided the guy's going to go bankrupt. He's not going to last. And they're going to remember that Breuer gave a hashgacha on toothpaste. So next year, there won't be any Adwe. That's what he thought. They're still around. It's already 50 years later. He assumed that, and he didn't want that people should not brush their teeth with toothpaste on Pesach. So he refused on principle to give a hechsher on the Adwe. The same thing, the mouthwash. Mouthwash, you taste it, it's awful. Not roi l'achila sodom. The mouthwash is kosher. All the non-kosher mouthwashes, they're all kosher.
Though not strictly related to Pesach, Rabbi Blumenkranz has in his sefer, Rabbi Blumenkranz Zal has in his sefer, whole alichas about shavers, that he likes the shavers, that the electric shavers that don't work very well, that In other words, he doesn't like the way it's cut and with the screens and with the thing. So I was wondering what the Rosh Hashiva's opinion was on that.
All year long. Shaving all year long. Yeah. It's a question. The Gemara says it's only prohibited to shave with a razor. And if you use scissors, then it's permissible. So Rav Moshe Feinstein originally thought that all the shavers were permissible years ago because they didn't really cut the hair at all. It crumbled the hair. Used to crush the hair. Used to have the shik shaver, I think, had a thing that went, the hair got stuck in the holes, and it had one piece of metal moving back and forth, so it would crumble the hair, like make it into powder. Now Moshe Feinstein said that that's permissible. But then they changed all the shavers. They no longer crumble the hair. They cut the hair. So Rabbi David Feinstein, the son of Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, said while his father was still alive, when he was an old man, he thinks that according to his understanding of what his father said, why it's permissible, he thinks some of the new shavers are prohibited. So I haven't followed since then. I started growing a beard just about then. I haven't been in touch. But it is a question. Some of them probably are prohibited.
Washing for meals or whatever. There are all these, when you can daven, when you can't daven. I mean, there are all these issues that...
Davening, you can daven as long as everyone is properly dressed in your area.
Sitting down.
Yes, strictly speaking, you can daven Shmoneh Esrei sitting down in a car or a plane if they ask you to sit. If they allow people to walk up and down the aisles and greet all the passengers, I can stand up for 2 minutes and daven Shmoneh Esrei also.
What does Rebbe do?
I usually daven standing up. I don't enjoy davening with a minyan. I don't think that's right. They usually wake everybody up, which is not permissible. You should really, but what can I do? What always happens is someone says, Rabbi Shechter, we're having a minyan. So what am I going to tell them? I don't want to daven in your minyan. But if they don't know who I am, so I just mind my own business and I daven where I want to daven. But what time are you supposed to daven? So the Gemara says that the Zman of davening, sunrise, sunset, and so on, is determined, let's say, on top of a mountain. So it looks as if the sun rises much earlier than it really does, and it looks like the sun sets much later than it really should be setting. So the Gemara in the end of Shabbos seems to imply, that sunrise and sunset is determined by sea level. Germany is in a valley. So the Maharil lived in Germany, so he says, we always daven mincha after the shkia. It's not true. It's before the Shkia, because Germany is in a valley, so it appears as if the sun set earlier, but it's really not true. The sunset is determined by sea level. If it would have not been in a valley, if it would have not been on top of a mountain, would have been everything sea level, flat, what time would the sun rise, what time would the sun set? So on a plane, you're really high up. So it doesn't depend on when it appears that the sun rises and the sun sets. It depends, if you would have been on the ground directly below, what time would the sunrise and the sunset be there? So there's a special website on the internet where zmanim.com or something.
Myzman.
So you have to write in what time your flight is leaving, where, and where you're going, and how long is it supposed to take. And if the flight is 10 minutes late, 20 minutes late, 30 minutes late, so they give you all of this money. How to calculate, they do all the work for you. They do all the math for you. Washing the tilis yadayim. They usually give you mezainis rolls and they say, only say mezainis. There is no such thing as mezainis rolls. Mezainis rolls are hamotzi. For several years, the OU refused to give a hashgacha on these rolls when they kept on writing that it's mezainis rolls. Now they have no choice. I don't know exactly why, but the OU now does give the Hashgacha, and the Hasidish rabbi who gives the Hashgacha writes that it's Mezainis. But all the Rabbanim in the OU all feel that it's not Mezainis, it's really Hamotzi. And when you go to a wedding, so a lot of times I'll put up a sign in the women's section that all the rolls in the women's section at the wedding are all Mezainis rolls. No such thing as Mezainis rolls. It tastes like bread, it looks like bread, it is bread. Hamotzi, it's not Mezainis. What else? What is there to know on an airplane? Don't travel on Shabbos.
There was a chazan, that's how I was told the stories before my time. There was a chazan in Washington Heights who was traveling in Europe, and the plane landed on Shabbos, and someone took a photograph of him, and they printed it in the Swiss newspaper, like we have the Jewish press, so they have some kind of a green newspaper that's printed in green ink, and they had his photograph on the first page, and the Balabatma had to hold in terror. I think they fired him. They fired him from his shul because he landed on Shabbos. So make sure you don't land on Shabbos.
Do you have a choice in putting on filling on the plane or waiting till you land, even though it's going
to
be in the afternoon?
No, you put on filling on the plane. Why shouldn't one want to wear filling on the plane? I remember once the stewardess was very nervous. They thought I was a terrorist or something when I was going to put on my tefillin. So I explained to her what it was. I remember once I was going El Al to Eretz Yisrael. So they had a Chinese woman, I think, who was checking all of I had my carry-on. So she opens up the talus and she opens up the tefillin. She said, "What's inside?" So I said to her, "Lady, if you don't know what's inside, you shouldn't be checking by El Al. Everybody's going to have talus and tefillin." So someone else explained to her what it was, that it's acceptable. You can wear tefillin on the airplane. That's the problem.
What are the considerations one should take into account when deciding whether they can rely on someone else for kashrus, proper food preparation, for example, accepting an invitation for Shabbos lunch? Are these standards any different for Pesach invitations?
Some communities had a custom not to eat by others on Pesach, even if the others are extremely observant, even if they're clearly more observant than I am. Most do not have such a custom. Most assume that Pesach is same as all year long. The Talmud has a principle, Eid Echad Neman B'Yisurim. When it comes to Kashrus, you don't have to have two witnesses to testify. One person is believed if that person himself observes Kashrus, but it's not magical. He's believed to the extent that he's knowledgeable. If the person is not sufficiently knowledgeable, he only realizes that the meat has to be kosher, and you have to have two sets of dishes, flesh and milk. He does know that the ketchup also has to be kosher. And all the other bottles can be trade also. Everything has to be kosher. So Eid Echad Neman B'Yisurim is not going to work like magic to the extent that the person is knowledgeable. You can trust them. You can believe them. If they themselves keep kosher both in the house and out of the house. If they only keep kosher at home, they don't keep kosher out of the house, and they don't have their manas, then they cannot be trusted even if they're serving you in the house. Only apply it, echad is believed, only if the person observes that area. Let's say the person does not observe taharas hamishpacha, but they do observe kashrus. So they're believed on kashrus. Let's say a woman does observe taharas hamishpacha, but does not observe kashrus. So she observes taharas hamishpacha, she can be trusted to be the mikveh lady, to tell me the mikveh is good, and to tell a woman that all of her hair was below the water, and so on. To the extent that a person is, in that mitzvah where the person is observant, so they have nemanis, they can be trusted, they can be believed, to the extent that they're knowledgeable. If the person does know all the laws of kashrus, it could be that there's something treif in their kitchen they're not really familiar with.
The next question was about shmura matzah. If Rebbe could explain that there is regular matzah, which has the OU certification, is that matzah not matzah that can be used at the first two nights of Pesach, the difference between shmura and regular matzah, and whether it's considered to be a hiddur or something that everyone should be doing as far as eating shmura matzah beyond the first two nights.
Mm-hmm. The store sell egg matzah also. Many Jews throughout America will use egg matzah to the Seder because they can't read the Hebrew letters. It says in small Hebrew letters that it's only permissible for Chol HaMisken. Why do they print it in Hebrew? They should print it in English. So Rabban Soloveitchik explained that he thinks that he used to give the Hashgacha on Streitz matzah. He thought that his Streitz egg matzahs are permissible even for the adults. Even if you're not Chayla Meskenim, it's also permissible. He gave a whole explanation why. So that's based on the practices. We don't eat egg matzahs on Pesach at all. Not only can you not use it for the Seder you have to have what we call lechemoni. The Chumash calls matzah lechemoni. The Gemara says lechemoni means poor bread, as opposed to matzah ashira. If it has eggs in it, or has flavoring in it, has wine in it, or has honey in it, when it was kneaded, when they kneaded the dough, That's called matzah ashir. So that's not acceptable for the Seder. We have a minhag, based on Rashi's opinion on the Gemara, we have a minhag not to eat egg matzahs full of Pesach, because Rashi understands in the Gemara that if you mix flour, Pesach tikka flour, mix flour with wine or with milk or with honey or with any of the other flavors, it won't become full chametz, that should have a punishment, of course, but the chimutz process will hasten, it'll begin to be chametz, to become chametz faster, quicker than 18 minutes. So it'll become chametz nuksha. Chametz nuksha means the beginning of the chimutz process will take place, it just won't be completed. So even though the Tosis disagrees with Rashi, so the minig of the Bali Tosis were all Rashi's grandchildren and great-grandchildren. So they all followed Rashi's lead. So Rashi says that you're not supposed to eat egg matzahs all of Pesach, it's a hashash of chametz nuksha. So that's as far as egg matzah. Then the Gemara talks about the matzah that you want to use for the Seder. So the Gemara has a dispute. Does it have to be shmura? You have to watch that it shouldn't become chametz from the time that it was harvested from the ground? Or is it sufficient if you're careful that it shouldn't become chametz from the time that you mixed it with water? Shmura mishas lisha. So there is an extreme opinion in the Gemara that we are machmir for it, so chumrah, that you should have shmura mishas ketzira. From the time you harvest it from the ground, theoretically, the grain that's growing in the ground could turn into chametz while it's still attached to the ground. But that's highly unlikely. The Gemara talks about such a possibility, the achmetz ben mechuber, became chametz while it's still attached to the ground. Because that's so far-fetched. So the rabbi said, you're not obligated to be concerned about that. If you see that the grain turned into chametz while it's still attached, you can't use it for the matzahs. But you don't have to be concerned about that. But that from the time you harvest it, that it could become chametz, that's more likely, but it's also unlikely. So the Gemara says, a machlekes, that's considered a chumrah. That for the Pesach night, for the Siddurim, you should have, for the Kazayis Matzah, which you want to use to the Yotz of the Mitzvah, you should have Shmur Mishas Ketzir, which is much more expensive. And then the rest of Pesach, it's not really a mitzvah to eat matzah, just if you're hungry, so you can't eat bread, so you have no choice, so you eat matzah. So for the rest of Pesach, it's not necessary to have Shmur, you can have plain matzah, pshuta matzahs. So there was, and some poskim make fun of the minhag. Some people have a custom, have a practice to insist on having shmura all of Pesach. So some of the poskim say it's so ridiculous. Even if a person observes that minhag, he doesn't have to. He doesn't even have to have a hataras nedarim because it's a minhag shtus. It's a silly minhag. So others say no, we shouldn't laugh so quickly because the Rambam sounds like he says like that. The Rambam sounds like he recommends lachatchila that a person should have shmura matzah all of Pesach. Even though it's far-fetched that it's going to turn into chametz after you detach it from the ground, it turns into chametz when you mix it, when you mix the flour with the water, and you let it sit there for a long, too long a period of time, that's when it's going to turn into chametz. So still, the Rambam says, the Rambam sounds like he says, you should have shmura matzah all the place. So that's only the Rambam's opinion. Shulchan Aruch, they don't even quote that. The commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch, they're making fun. They're making fun of the people who insist on having shmura all of Pesach. But in recent years, they came to the realization we should stop making fun, because the Rambam writes seems to say like that. You should have shmura all of this.
Machine shmura versus hand shmura.
Right. The shmura has two parts to it. One part of shmura is shima michimut. You're careful that it didn't turn into chametz. Extra careful that it didn't turn into chametz. And the second part of Shmura is that you baked it lishma. So that's the question. When a Jew pushes the button and he says, I'm pushing the button on the machine that to bake the matzahs to be used for the mitzvah, is that considered asiyah lishma? So most assume that yes. Most assume that yes. If yes, then many hold that that's a hidur, because the machine matzahs are baked much quicker than the hand matzahs. Now, when they first made machine matzahs, the machine matzahs took five times as long. And the machine was just to make it thinner and to have it in a square shape. So it took five times as long, so the Rabbanim said it's chametz gomer. The machine matzah chametz gomer. But in recent years, the machine matzahs take less than half the time of the hand matzahs. So that's why those who assume that machine, pushing the button on the machine is considered lishma, the chazanish, and all the major poskim, they all say like that. So in Eretz Yisrael Yerushalayim, that was the hiddur, to dafka use machine shmur as opposed to hand shmur.
So what's the intent of the shmur? For just the Seder night?
To use it for the Seder night,
no,
for the mitzvah.
It's not for all Pesach?
No, no. For the rest of Pesach, it's just shima mechimetz, to have extra caution that it shouldn't turn into chametz. So the Rambam says like that. The Rambam sounds like he says that l'chaktila, more correct is to have shmur matzah all of Pesach because of the chashash of chametz. The Gemara says if you mix flour with water, it's going to take if your wife makes challis for Shabbos and you mix flour with water, it takes a few hours till it rises. So you throw in yeast, that takes 2 hours instead of 10 hours. If you don't throw in yeast, it's going to take forever. So the Gemara says if you mix flour with water, you let it sit by itself. How do you know when the chametz process began? So the Gemara says simonim. If it looks like this, if it rises and has cracks on top and it starts turning grayish on the top, the color changes a little bit. So the Gemara says if it's less than a sheer mil, if the flour with the water is sitting less than the amount of time that it takes to walk a mil is alpaim amo, 2,000 amos, a mil is a Roman measure, a kilometer. So if it's sitting less than a mil, for sure it did not become chametz. So the Mishnah Brura quotes that a sheer mil is 18 minutes. But Professor Leo Levy published a book. Leo Levy was used to live in Washington Heights, and then he was the head of Machon Lev for quite a few years. Now he's retired. I think he's still alive. Now he's retired. He's an old man. So Leo Levy published a book on Zmane Hayom B'Halocha, how to determine when sunrise is and when sunset is and when Beit HaShemashos is and so on. So in his book, he explains that the 18 minutes is a mistake. They were working with a different time system. What they write is 18 minutes, and our time system, it's 22 and a half minutes. It shows from the Gemara like that, that their 18 minutes had more seconds than ours. They had more than 60 seconds to a minute. So what they call 18 minutes is really 22 and a half minutes by yourself. So that's the Hidur, that people only want to use 18-minute matzah. They only want it in the yeshivas when they go to the factory where they bake the matzah, so they only take the matzahs from the first 18 minutes. Because in the matzah factories where they bake the matzahs, there's always a little dough that falls off and then it goes back in, and then they use it again. The system is such that there's always a little dough that was sitting there for a long, long time, and it falls back in. So if you only use the matzahs in the first 18 minutes, for sure it can't become chametz. If you have flour sitting with water for less than 22 and a half minutes, what the Mishnah Brura says, 18 minutes, for sure it's not chametz. So that's why there's a hiddur to have 18-minute matzahs. One year, the students in yeshiva were selling 16-minute matzahs. Some of the people didn't want to buy it. They want to buy dafka 18-minute matzahs. Chai, they thought it's a gematria chai. It has nothing to do with chai. Anything less than 18 minutes cannot be chametz. And really, 18 minutes by us means 22 and a half minutes. But if it's less than that, it's avadigat. The whole Hidur, many in Yerushalayim, many in the Soloveitchik family, they insist dafka on using the machine matzahs, because the machine matzahs are way less than the hand matzahs. Machine matzahs are baked much quicker than the hand matzahs, so there's much less chance of it becoming chametz.
You come from the Torah, some people, at least some people
baked after Chatzos on Erev Pesach, right. Rashi is quoted in different sources as having had come up with this chumrah, that the two versions of what Rashi said. So the original version, the earliest version, is that Rashi insisted that just like the Korban Pesach has to be slaughtered after Chatzos, in the afternoon of Erev Pesach, and if you shech the Korban Pesach earlier in the day, it's possible it's not acceptable. And the Gemara makes an equation between the Zman of Korban Pesach and the Zman of Matzah. The Gemara makes a connection with respect to eating the Korban Pesach. You cannot eat the Korban Pesach after midnight. So according to the Tana who thinks that that's a biblical din, we paskin it's only midirabbanan. But according to one Tana, that's a real biblical din. You have to finish eating the Korban Pesach by midnight. So according to that Tana, you have to finish eating Matzah by midnight also. So Rashi says that not only is there a connection between matzah and Korban Pesach with respect to the last time of eating it, there's a connection with respect to preparing the Korban Pesach. Korban Pesach can only be slaughtered after noon on Erev Pesach, so the matzah cannot be baked earlier. Matzah has to be baked in the afternoon. And then other Rishonim, other sources, quote from Rashi, that Rashi used to bake the matzahs early in the morning, before Shacharis, on Erev Pesach. You're not allowed to do anything before you daven Shacharis, no, but this was a mitzvah, to bake the matzahs. So that version quotes Rashi as saying has nothing to do with the slaughtering of the Korban Pesach. So Rabbi Soloveitchik liked the second version rather than the first. He thought the explanation was the following, that the Gemara says it's only considered matzah if it could have become chametz. Only the five kinds of grain are acceptable for matzah because it has to be something that's boli deifimut. If you were to let it sit long enough, the flour with the water, let it sit long enough, it would turn into chametz. So you were careful and you baked it quickly, so it's matzah. But before Erev Pesach, there's no concept of chametz. The concept of the chametz doesn't exist all year long. It only exists on Erev Pesach in the morning. That's when you have the mitzvah to destroy the chametz. Erev Pesach in the afternoon, you're not allowed to eat chametz already. On Pesach, you're not allowed to eat chametz. You're not allowed to get any, not allowed to sell chametz. Not allowed to get any benefit from chametz. So starting from Erev Pesach in the morning is when there's a concept of chametz. Only then does the concept of matzah mean something. So you can only bake the matzahs on starting from Erev Pesach in the morning, because the matzah has to be such that if you would have let it stay longer, it would have become chametz. Before Erev Pesach, it can't become chametz. There's no concept of chametz all year long. The concept of chametz is only relevant beginning Erev Pesach in the morning.
But you're always burning it after Shacharis, so Rosh is doing it beforehand. It's not chametz till later.
No, you can burn it earlier too. You can burn it as early as you want, Erev Pesach in the morning. The zman is Erev Pesach in the morning to burn the chametz. Then after the afternoon of Erev Pesach, the zman that you're not allowed to eat chametz min haTorah. So these are the two versions of what Rashi said. Rabbi Soloveitchik liked the second version better than the first version, because they quote that Rashi himself baked the matzahs early in the morning before Chatzos. So in the days of the Bali HaTesis, this was the common practice. That tiny little communities, the Crusaders, when they traveled, they killed the. They wiped out complete Jewish communities, but the community, it wasn't like the Nazis. They didn't have a community of 1,000 Jews. They had barely a minion in every city. So if you have two families live in a village, and you have 25 people, 25 Jewish people, so you can take matzahs to 25 people. If you live in New York City, you have so many Jews, it's impossible. You can't bake matzahs for a million Jews. You live over here. You have how many thousands of Jews live in over here? It's impossible to have the chumrah if you have a big city. So nobody observes it now. The Vilna Gaon didn't like the whole chumrah. The Vilna Gaon didn't like it. So by the Misnagdim, they don't follow. Whatever the Vilna Gaon left at, so the Misnagdim don't observe.
And there was one example, if you made matzahs
in the afternoon, that there could be a question that
sometimes the matzahs around the world, exactly, so it's better not to.
Sure, it's a bigger problem, right? The matzah companies already stopped baking matzahs before Purim. They already stopped baking matzahs. By the Hasidim, they're going to bake matzahs on Erev Pesach in the afternoon. But because this was the practice of Rashi and all the Bali HaTesis, but because the Vilna Gaon made fun of it, that's why the Misnagdim don't observe this position any longer.
Okay, the next question is off the topic of Pesach. It was sent to me as follows, sent to Harold as follows. L'chvoda Rav Shechter, I'm not intending insolence with my two-part question, so please accept my question in that light. Part one, I've been reading the Pew Report concerning the state of Jewishness in the United States. Orthodoxy is robust, while we are witnessing the loss of nearly all those that aren't. Along come a bunch of young girls, and they don tefillin. While I'm sure that some are feminists, I am also confident that others are doing so out of a spiritual desire to worship Hashem in a more spiritual fashion. While recognizing that this behavior is wrong, the vituperative tongue-lashing that these girls and the rabbis who endorse them are receiving seems out of proportion to the act. It is not as if they are worshiping Yeshu HaNotzri in some fashion. Can you please elaborate?
Sure. The question starts off, the person read the Pew Report and he realizes that the conservative and the reform are dying. This is from the conservatives. The conservatives don't accept halacha of the Torah Shebaalpeh. So the conservatives don't see, they have a whole explanation why the women today have education, the same education as the men have. and therefore the women should be obligated to put on tefillin the same as the men. This is straight from the conservatives. One of the girls who started the whole story, her both grandfathers are conservative rabbis. She was brought up conservative all of her life. So we don't endorse conservative practices because the conservatives are going to disappear. Exactly why? We discourage people from having conservative practices. And it's interesting, I couldn't believe it, on the side of the Rif, you have the commentary called Shilta Gagiborim. So the Shilta Gagiborim quotes from Rabbeinu Yishai Riaz, Rabbeinu Yishai Achron, the grandson of the Tosfos Rit, who lived several centuries ago. He says, women should not wear tefillin because that's the practice of the Reformed Jews. This is what he writes centuries ago. You're not allowed to do something that smacks from conservative Judaism. So that's exactly, we want the Jewish religion to remain and to flourish. So if you're going to imitate the ways of the conservatives, you're going to disappear the same way the conservatives are disappearing, unfortunately. Several years ago, Dr. Lam was in Eretz Yisrael, so they interviewed him from some newspaper, so they're asking him about Judaism in America. So he said, unfortunately, we have to recite Kaddish over the conservatives, because they're all dying out. So they attacked him in the newspaper. What are they attacking? He said, unfortunately, you have to recite Kaddish over the conservatives. They're all disappearing. They're all dying. He says, unfortunately, that's a fact. The fact is, whoever breaks away from traditional Judaism, whoever does shtick, is going to disappear. They won't disappear in this generation, they'll disappear in the next generation. The conservatives thought that they were conserving. They thought they were saving Judaism with their minor adjustments. And they didn't conserve anything. They were all disappearing. So this shtick of the girls wearing tefillin is straight 100% from the conservatives. It's not from the Orthodox. So the Rabbanim insist you're not permitted to imitate the ways of the conservatives. Very simple. And the tongue lashing was not against the girls. Tongue lashing was against the rabbis who are blind and they can't see what's under their noses. When Rav Belville the Soloveitchik passed away, so they wrote up in the newspapers, that was a long time ago, so they wrote up in the newspapers different things that he said at different times. So he said, my father, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, had such insight, he could analyze the situation, and he can tell you if you go in this direction, what will be the result in another 60 years, and you go in that direction, what will be the result in another 60 years. And he said, I don't have that ability to analyze so well. He paused for a moment, and then he added on, but I think I have a mila over the other Rabbonim in my generation. At least I can see what's under my nose. The others don't even see what's under their nose. What's the matter? You don't see, this is straight from the conservatives. 100% from the conservatives. Of course we're opposed to it.
Any other questions? Yes, John.
Would it be permissible for Orthodox people, Orthodox rabbis, to sell tefillin or talasim to girls?
Permissible. Okay, it's permissible.
Would it be a problem?
I don't think so. I'm not God's policeman. They're not going to throw it in the garbage.
But on that subject, as far as a sofer is concerned, a sofer, let's say, selling Sefer Torah, that they've written to someone who doesn't keep the Shulchan Aruch, would the same concept apply?
If you're afraid he's going to throw the Sefer Torah on the floor, he's going to spit on it, so you don't. But if you think he's going to treat it with respect, okay. He's going to give women aliyahs on Shabbos. That's not my responsibility. He's going to treat it with respect, so it's permissible.
Any other questions on this subject before we went back to Pesach? Yes?
How about the women's opinion that they have to speak with the women who gather,
the question is about what is Rebbe's feeling about the women who gather to daven Kabbalah Shabbos?
Women say Kabbalah Shabbos for the men, or the women have their own men?
They have their own men.
They get together.
They get together?
There are a group of women who get together in different people's houses.
Okay, they get together, fine. But why don't they want to go to shul? I never have a desire to daven for an omer. I don't have a desire to get an aliyah. I don't know, why do the women think that they have to get an aliyah and they have to daven for an omer? Because the men have that shtick. The men have the shtick. There are men who have to get mafta every week. this week he has yard sale for his grandfather, next week he has yard sale for his mother-in-law, then he has yard sale for his cousin. So it's like an entitlement. He has to daven for an almana and he has to get them after. It's not supposed to be an entitlement. Whenever whoever davens for an almana is basically compromising on his own tznius. The definition of tznius means that we should lead a private life, not to do things in public. I'm always compromising, I'm always speaking in public. But I have no choice. Someone has to compromise on their privacy. So the Torah tells us it's bad enough that the men have to compromise on their privacy. And the rabbis comment on the pasuk, "Son tos malach melech, melech v'lo malka." You shouldn't appoint a woman to be the king, unless you have no choice. Unless the best one, the only one cut out for the job is a woman. But otherwise, really, no one should want to serve as a king. But if you need someone to be the head of the police or the president of the shul or the rabbi, so it's bad enough that the men have to compromise. We said, let the women not have to compromise on their tznius, on their privacy. So the women today act as if like the men. The men, Rabbi Soloveitchik explained, he said in America, this is so, the whole concept of tznius is so foreign. In America, the attitude is, you tell the journalist, write about me whatever you want, good or bad, make sure you spell my name right, and you put my picture in the newspaper. In America, everything revolves about advertisement and pushing yourself. And that the whole thing, the whole thrust of the American style of living is against the style of the Torah. The Torah wants everyone to lead a tznius d'pi alayim. Tznius doesn't only mean to wear clothing that cover your body. That's one part of tznius. The basic part of tznius is to do things b'tzina as opposed to b'farhesia, to lead a private life, to be a quiet person, lead a private life. There's a boy comes into the Beis Medrash with an orange sweater that everybody should see who he is. Or he davens, he screams out loud by the davening. Everybody has to announce to the public that he's here. Or he walks in to the Beis Medrash, he walks to the front row, or he walks to the back row. He does something that everyone should notice that he's there. So this is a violation of tznius. This is a violation of tznius. So the Jewish attitude is that it's bad enough that the men have to sometimes compromise on their tznius. We would prefer never to. But the women should not have to compromise on their tznius. If you have no choice, if the only one who can serve as the president of the shul is a woman, so you have no choice. But otherwise, it's not right. There was one of the musmachim from the yeshiva, whose family was very close with Rabbi Soloveitchik, was a rabbi in the Midwest, and one of the women, there was an election for president in the shul, so one of the women wanted to run for president. So he spoke to Rabbi Soloveitchik about the issue on the telephone, so he told him that he should resign from the rabbinate. If they're not going to listen to him and they're going to appoint a woman as the president, he should resign from the rabbinate. So it turned out that he spoke to them, and the woman did not run for president. He left the rabbinate anyway. Not because of that issue, they did listen to him. Rabbi Soloveitchik thought that it's so improper. He told the rabbi, if the Balabatim are going to insist on appointing a woman president, he should recommend that he should resign from the shul. It's not right.
Rabbi will address the second night of Yom Tov, taking away from the first day and davening early. Is that something which is permissible?
The Yekis have a practice that even if they daven early the first day Yom Tov, but they won't begin Borchu on the second night of Yom Tov till after it's Tzeis HaKechavim. Because they're afraid, this is the German minute, because they're afraid that Balabasta will be at home. She's nervous her husband is going to soon come home to eat, to make Kiddush and eat the meal. So she may start cooking the food late in the afternoon on the first day Yom Tov for the second day, which is not permissible unless the second day is Shabbos. But if it's 2 days Yom Tov, no Shabbos, then you're not permitted to cook on the first day for the second day. The rest of the Jewish world didn't have such a minig. The din is you're not permitted to prepare food on the first day for the second. Not allowed to set the table either. But there's nothing wrong with davening. If there's nothing wrong with davening early the first night, there's nothing wrong with davening early on the second night. You're not taking away from the first day. It's super important. The reason why we observe the second day Yom Tov is because we make believe as if there's a suffix, as if we're not sure whether yesterday was Yom Tov or today. So if yesterday was Yom Tov, so the whole day will be Yom Tov till the end of the day. If yesterday was not Yom Tov, so today is Yom Tov. Okay, you're not really taking away from the first day. The only question was about the second night of Shavuos. that in many communities the practice was that they wouldn't daven Maariv in shul until after Tzeisar Kachovim on Shavuos, because the pasuk says you should count Sfiras HaOmer, it should be Sheva Shabbos as Tamimos, 7 full weeks. So if you're going to be Mekabel Shavuos early, so you're going to be chopping, you're going to be taking away a few hours from the 7 full weeks. You're not taking away anything, but that's a minhag developed like that. Not to daven early, there were different minhagim. Some communities, the minhag was not to say Kiddush at home before Tzeisar Kachovim. In other communities, the minhag was not to begin davening Maariv on the first night of Shavuos till after Tzeisar Kachov. So there are two opinions. What about the second night of Shavuos? Because second night of Shavuos, you're not counting Sfiras HaOmer anymore. So it's already after the Sheva Shabbos is Tamimos. So some insisted that since the first night of Shavuos, the minhag is that you don't daven Maariv till Tzeisar Kachov, so the second night should be the same as the first night. And the Pirim Gadol makes fun of that. He thinks that it doesn't make any sense. Second night Shavuos, you may daven early. Except for the Yekkes. The Yekkes, any second night Yom Tov, they don't daven early. They don't begin Maariv until left. It says, come, second night Yom Tov, because they're afraid the women will prepare in advance.
I think there's a Shifa of Ashram that says, I can't only the outcome is permitted. And the guy is, so what does Rabbi feel about, I guess, clean way to clean after a meal for the next day, or to set
a
table for the next day, the next evening, even though it's not
nighttime
yet.
It's not right. In all the hotels where they have hashgachas, they don't permit it. All the kashrus of the Jews. Strictly speaking, it is permissible, but it's not a good idea. Right. Yes, yes. In the days of the Beis Hamikdash, the Korban Pesach had to be broiled. And after the destruction of the Beis Hamikdash, two customs developed. So some had the custom to have broiled on Pesach night as a zecher. We should remind ourselves that we used to bring a Korban Pesach. And other communities had the minhag bedavka not to have broiled meat or even chicken on the first night of Pesach, two nights of Pesach. No one should think that we're eating a Korban Pesach outside of the Beis Hamikdash. So that now, the Mishnah records the two minhagim. The Mishnah records soon after the destruction of the second Beis Hamikdash, there were these two minhagim, bedavka yes or bedavka no. So Ashkenazim have the minhag, the bedavka no. We don't have broiled, and you don't even have broiled chicken. Broiled fish is okay, it doesn't need shechita, but anything that needs shechita, so the meaning is we don't have it broiled, and no one should think that that anybody's eating a Korban Pesach outside of the Beis Hamikdash. Most have the practice that you don't have pot roast either. Even though it's going to give out its own juice, it's going to have a little juice, so you have to have gedemta chicken. There should be a lot of liquid.
Could it be something which is fried with breading? Something, let's say chicken or meat that's fried?
Yeah.
Considered to be the same thing. I think it's not broiled.
Yeah.
So let's say that chicken or meat that's fried, with that has breading on it, even though it doesn't have any juice.
What do you mean, has matzah and all that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So would that be something that would be permitted?
I think most have the custom not to. I think so.
Any other questions? Yeah.
Just a gross question going back to that. I have a brother who loves him, but he does not eat the brush. But his sons have no chassidish, no ties at all, right? And he doesn't work chassidish, but he's got chassidish practice. So his sons would love not to keep brush. But their father does, and he's alive and well, and there is a concern about, kibbutz and not keeping the brachos, even though they have no shaykhus. So I'm assuming that even, I don't know this, I'm asking, even if they went to a beis din and did a hetzer, would that permit them to not eat the butter because of the issue of the father, probably even that is going to happen.
I don't think Hatars and Dorim would help if they go to a Bezin because it's not their minig. It's a family minig. It's a community minig. The only thing is that they no longer belong to that community. They joined a different community. They don't follow any of the Hasidic practices of the father. Good, okay. Fine, Orthodox Jews, they belong to a different community. Like if a Jew would move from one community to another, so he's no longer bound by the minhagim of that community, he's bound by the minhagim of this community. So there's nothing wrong with that. They don't want to rub the father the wrong way. That's a nice thing. But strictly speaking, they should ask their own local Orthodox rabbi. But strictly speaking, I don't think they even need a Hataras and Dorim. They're no longer part of that community. They belong to a different community.
In 1 year, can they go from one minhag to the other minhag? I mean, you just break away, they say, that for the past 40 years, I've been holding like my father's minhag. I've been living now in this community for 20 years, so I'll keep.
Yeah. My family meaning is that we always ate gebrucks. My father came from a Hasidic background in Europe, but then he came to YU, he came to America, so he changed his tefillin, everything became like misnagdim. Everything became like misnagdim. Did everything. He converted. He became no longer a Hasid, became a misnagdim. So I was brought up, we always ate gebrucks. My wife doesn't make gebrucks, so she doesn't eat, but I didn't adopt a minute. She doesn't want to make gebrucks, okay.
Don't buy it.
Fine. Okay, I'll live without it.
Any last question, yes?
How much time waiting for the spirit period to seem like 2 days before? So I assume that what I thought was that you're invited, you should go, but you're not supposed to be invited.
Right, Rav Moshe Feinstein writes, and Rav Soloveitchik said the same. That's their ASIC. The Chos and Kala have to decide whether they're allowed to get married or not. But once they decide they're getting married, even if they get married in that part of Sphira, that L'chola day is they're not supposed to. Let's say between Rosh Chodesh Ir and Lag BaOmer, all the Minhagim have that you're not supposed to get married. But once they decide to get married, then that's their problem, whether they're doing right or wrong. Once they get married, so we're permitted to participate because it's a Suda's Mitzvah. We're allowed to go. And they have to determine what's their family minhag. When are they? When is it proper for them to get married and when not? That's their problem.
Thank you, everyone.
Very good. Amen.
We have
We have six.